succession number 27060, reel 3.
This is the second reel of a taped interview with Bill Stacey in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 11th of the 5th, 2004, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Bill, can we go back a little way? You've been talking about your experience in Tobruk. What were you told about going to Tobruk initially? Did anyone explain or give you briefings about what was going on?
No, they did, actually. They said that people who were going to engage were heavily dug in and well fortified. Everything was well fortified and had been there for a long time and had plenty of time to do what they wanted to do as far as defences were concerned. And that proved to be the fact when we got up there, because they were we didn't go in at Bardia. We came in late at Tobruk, but the Bardia defences were also formidable, and we could see afterwards as we went through there that there was quite a tussle for a while, but the Australian troops got over the top of them fairly quickly, although they were casualties. So we took off from Aikangi Maru in the early hours of the morning in a dust storm, and the first thing that happened was that one of the ammunition trucks had been loaded incorrectly, and they had all the shot up against the driver's cabin, and the first, when they went through the tank trap, it bounced and kinked the chassis of the truck, and that truck went right through the desert up to Elajula and back with a kinked chassis, and and never had in the slightest bit of worry with it. But my personal experience was that it was a big area, and it was dry and dusty, and you'd wonder how anybody ever lived there over the centuries, you know.
Why anyone would want it.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Did you ever think at this point, okay, now this is your first experience, you're actually going to head into action.
Action, yeah.
Did you ever consider what that might mean?
Oh, I think I did. I think I realised that you were going into an area where you might not come back from, but that was what you were a soldier for. And and once the action starts, you put all that in the back of your mind. You know. I never ever thought about it once.
People talk of fighting for king and country. Was that something that you thought of at that time?
Oh, yes. As I said before, I've always been a monarchist, and I really do think that most of the troops there thought that they were not only fighting for Australia, they were fighting for their heritage.
Did that change the closer you got to the realities of war, though?
No, I don't think it did. I don't think it ever did.
So what then of killing for king and country?
Yeah, well, it's part and parcel of the business. I mean, you don't go up there to pat people on the back. You go up there to either they kill you or you kill them, and it's a terrible thing. It really is a terrible thing, because the people that are getting killed are just the same as you and your mate next beside you. They've probably got families and girlfriends. And
did you think of those things?
Yeah, I did when I saw them dead. You know, we, one stage of the game in Tobruk, we went through the area where most of our barrage went on, and it was a terrible experience.
You mentioned that earlier.
Yes, that's right.
I wanted to talk about the sort of preparation then, the arrival and the preparation set up of this particular barrage. What did that involve, actually getting to your destination?
We got our first gun positions were outside Tobruk, and I don't know who the direction was. I think it probably would have been a British command that was in charge. And they allotted our position, gave us our targets, and sent our forward observation officers forward to do the shoot. And it all started with a big bang about 5 o'clock in the morning, you know. It went woof, and away the whole sky and everything lit up. And when we, as I said before, when we It didn't take long for the infantry to get into Tobruk, really. Once they overrun the outside defence, the outside posts, they overrun it pretty quickly. And the first person I saw dead was the 2nd, 4th Battalion fella, and he was just lying. I wasn't sure whether he was shot or whether it was a landmine. The thing just went on, and the stretcher bearers hadn't arrived at that period to take him away, you know.
How did that initial experience affect
you? Well, it was a shock. He was the first casualty that I personally saw, and it went through, you know, how bloody terrible, really, you know. And there's that fellow. I didn't know him, but he was an Australian and a compatriot, and now his life's gone and finished, you know. That's just what I thought. But then there were other things to do, and away you went, you know.
Mm. In relation to, you mentioned, boom, and it all goes off. Can you give us an idea of the feelings that you had at that moment?
Well, it was that moment for us. It was a feeling of elation because it was our first engagement, you know, the first time we'd engaged the enemy, and it was all tensed up. But once it went off, everybody sort of settled down into a routine then. But those first build-ups of the first salvo, everything was as tense as anything. But once the initial gunfire started, everything went back to normal, and they've just done their jobs, you know.
You're obviously hearing your guns go off, you're seeing the flash, feeling the shudder. What of the sense of what's happening at the other end?
Yeah, well, you think of that too. You wonder what's happening, you know. But mostly you think about, I hope the shells are level in the right place, you know, that they're doing the work they're supposed to be doing, because actually that's your job, you know. It's you want them to land in the place where they'll do the most damage.
People talk of the drop shorts. Nickname for the gunners,
You do. That's an occasional you get one, and especially in, I don't want to go back to New Guinea now, but it was a bigger, it occurred more often there than it did in the desert warfare, because there was no obstruction in front of you, you know.
Do you see where your shells are landing?
No. It's probably 6 miles away where the gunners are, from the gun positions to the actual target.
What sort of security do you feel, given that you're 6 miles away from the action?
You have your own posts out, you know, naturally, in case somebody sneaks up on you or something like that, but it's usually because the infantry in front of you, you know, and the pioneers and all these people, and especially when you're advancing, you know that there's that buffer there all the time, and all you've got to be careful of is no stragglers sneaking back, you know, people that have been missed on the way in.
Was there that sort of thing that you held in the back of your mind when you were joining the gunners, that you would actually not necessarily be in the immediate front line?
No, I don't think that. I really don't think that entered my mind anyway. It was just a matter of, you're a soldier at war. You know, I didn't think, even when later on when they started the 9 mile snipers and all this sort of thing, that got dissipated very, very quickly in Greece because. You don't want to talk about that now anyway, do you?
We can if you like. Yep.
Well, see, they call the Greece the Gunners' War because it was a set-piece retreat. The infantry had stopped, the Germans had built up, the infantry had retreat, we'd retreat. But there, the infantry came through our lines and we engaged the Germans and then packed up and got through and went back to the next gun position and waited for the infantry to come back through our line. So, you know, it was a lot of close targets in those, at that time, but that I think is the only time in my regiment's history that we were so close to the front actual front line, because at stages we were the front line. Yeah.
All right, we'll go to that in a little while. The initial experience of firing a gun, you mentioned this elation. Yeah. let's talk. Continue to talk about that. What is involved in firing a gun, and in this particular instance, how fast were you firing it?
Well, of course, the main person on a gun is what they call the layer, and the quicker he can lay the gun and report to his sergeant that the gun's ready, the quicker it's fired, you know. And in the old 18-pounder days with the fixed ammunition, it was just a matter of shoving the shell and firing. With the 25-pounder, it was separated ammunition. The charge had to be checked before the shell rammed and the charges checked, and you took one increment out or left them all in, depending on what power that you wanted. And still, the layer was the man that laid the gun and reported when it was ready to fire. You know.
So how often would he be doing that a set space of time, on average, in this particular case?
No, I'm not sure of the firing rate, but I reckon about 3 or 4 a minute they'd be getting away. Yeah, but Rex would know all about that. He was a sergeant on the gun, so... Yeah, I'm not sure about the firing rate at all. But they just... When they see the order comes through, 10 rounds gunfire, well, each gunfire fires 10 rounds and then stops and waits for a correction, and then they might change the system at all when it salvos. You know, the whole regiment salvos, or the battery. Mostly, well, up the desert was a battery, because there's only one battery of the 2nd, 3rd, 4th Regiment went to the desert.
So how long were you involved in that particular barrage for?
Oh, that first barrage, it started next morning, in the morning, and from memory, I think it was a day and a half, and they were into Brook, you know, they'd overrun it in that quick period, and not a lot of counter battery work from the Italians as far as the artillery was concerned, although we were driving up the road in a truck, and we overrun the turn off point, and we got about half a mile further up, and the next thing, a shell lands about 200 yards. Well, I tell you what, you never seen a truck turn around so quick in the hole. Because that was the first shell that ever came our way, you know. And, it was very hard work for the gunners in the desert, because they moved so quickly, they hardly had a gun position, dug, and it was time to go again, you know. And the same in Greece, at continually making new gun positions.
You mentioned that you would have spent a short time in Tobruk before you were moved on. How long were you to actually be in Tobruk for?
Well, we were only there 2 days, 3 days.
What did you do in that time?
Mostly we saw that everything was shipshape again, you know, reorganised, you know. Everything gets out of kilter and you've got to reorganise, restore, bring ammunition up, never everything ready to go again, you know. And we got held up between Tobruk and Derna. And the Italians had a gun up there, which they fired and then run away, but then they had to be investigated before. When we got to the top of the escarpment, they'd blown the bridge away. So the engineers come along and they made a track down the side of the... I tell you what, this is a real steep hill. And when you got halfway down, you had to do a left-hand turn. And those guns, you know, there's no traction on the guns. And when drivers start to turn, the guns are slipping down sideways it's just a dugout track, you know, straight down the side of the into Derna. Yeah, hair-raising experience. That.
You mentioned some of your experience in relation to POWs on your way up to Tobruk, probably having been taken from places like Bardia. What of your experience of the Italians in Tobruk? Any?
As I said before, you know, there was, on the next morning after they went into Tobruk, must have been 100,000 of them up on the side of this hill, the whole of the Italian army, I reckon. And my feelings were, I felt terribly sorry, you know, because they're human beings and they didn't have the facilities to look after them or treat them properly. Like even, you know, we were battling for water, and then, as I think I said before, a mate of mine named Dave Payton, he got killed. But he took two or three truckloads of water to them so they could get a drink even, you know.
You mentioned that. I thought that was prior too. In relation to Tobruk, you mentioned some of the food. What are the spoils of war at Tobruk? What have you experienced with that?
Well, we weren't getting too much as far as Tucker was concerned. My unit, personally, we got into this storage area and... Of course, the Italians used to get all their beef from Argentina. It was called Fray Bentos, and it was just steak in tins. It was magnificent. And, of course, our old stuff was bully beef and, you know, corned beef. And the Italians are also experts at the art of dehydrated vegetables. And you get a couple of tins of this Fray Bentos beef and a half a brick of... Italian dehydrated vegetables, and you had the best stew you ever had in your life. And we lived on that. We actually lived on it. And then we also got into a cave, and it was just completely loaded with not brandy, what's the other stuff? Better than brandy.
Cognac.
Absolutely loaded with cognac and Vinci water. Now, I didn't drink at the time, but I used to love that Vinci water. And my mate, Doug James, you think he gave that cognac some for his corner? And one day, he used to keep a bottle of cognac over on the side of the truck, and I had a couple of bottles of Vinci water. And I put my hand over, grabbed the bottle, and I took a good full neck of it before I realised I had his brandy, you know, and nearly killed me. I nearly died. Yeah.
A lot of people talk of vehicles and motorbikes, weaponry. Did you experience anything like that?
Yeah, well, there's another thing too. We got into a big Italian workshop outside Benghazi, and our Donars were riding these Italian motorbikes rather than the old Beezers. You know, they put their Beezers on the back of the truck and rode these... what was the name? I forget the name of them. Yeah. But they were beautiful motorbikes, you know. And the Italians had some marvellous transport and MT. But the only trouble is they didn't seem to know how to maintain them. I saw a truck there. I reckon you could have easily played a game of tennis on the back of it. And it was stopped in the middle of the desert. Big flat top. I don't even know what they used it for. But anyhow... One of our LADs come along, and it took him about 3 minutes, and away the big, this bloody great big Fiat diesel burst into life, and away she went, you know. We had quite a few extra vehicles in the regiment, the Italian vehicles, but when we came back, when we were coming back, the MPs, I think it was about Bardia, they took them all off us, you know. We went on to up through Benghazi and up onto the Quantine Marshes. Mm. That's where we first run into the Italians.
Before we get to that point, let's talk about the initial success and how that made you feel in relation to your experience of warfare.
Well, it made us feel as if we were unbeatable, you know. The Aussies again, here we go. Anybody else around, you know, we'll fix you up very quickly. And that was... only because of the quality of the opposition that we struck at the time, you know. Because for the defences that were there, which was proved later on when Rommel come down, they couldn't get the Australians out of Tobruk But we got the Australians out, the Italians out in a day and a half, and the Germans were there for months trying to get them out. You know, that's how good the terrain suited itself for defence. You know, there were big wadis, deep wadis, where, you know, it's almost impossible to penetrate with artillery fire and that sort of thing. And but we really did think we were trumps after we got out of Tobruk, you know. And it was until we came back and went to Greece that changed the tune a bit. Yeah. But I think my feelings were the same as everybody else's. It was just a great feeling to think that we'd followed in the Anzac tradition and done the job that was supposed to be done, you know, and done it well.
Well, what were those Anzac traditions that people would carry?
The word Anzac alone, you know, in Australia, it's synonymous with everybody that's fair dinkum, that'll have a go, that stand up for their rights, that do what they're told, and good soldiers, but carefree soldiers, not as disciplined as maybe our British counterparts, but they're still in the same, you know, like, nobody can beat a good British soldier, I don't care what anybody says. They can't, you know, they're so well trained, so disciplined, and they accept discipline too. Not like our fellas are more open than that. They'll do what they're told, but they question what's got to happen, you know. If somebody says to them, "We want you to go that head on into that machine gun nest," they say, "Well, it might be better if we went around this way or that way," where the British should go straight in there and get killed, our fellas would go around the back, you know. Just independence, I suppose you could call it, you know.
Well, I'm interested that you say that, because my impression is that the Australians had a bit of a reputation from the First World War in the area.
Yeah.
What was that, and how had it come about, do you think?
Well, I think that it was a sense of esprit de corps more than anything. Australians are great ones, you know, for if they take a job on, and I don't say this in a flamboyant way, but the average Australian decides to do something, he does it to the best he possibly can, you know, and if he can't, he'll find a way to, he's more innovative. You know, they don't always stick strictly to what's laid down, and yet it's in 9 cases out of 10 it'll work out okay, you know, if it's a little bit out of the general way of doing things. But they're very proud people, and the Australian soldiers are proud soldiers. You don't let anybody, it's all bullshit about, you know, they say. And our CO, somebody said to our CO, "Gee, they're quiet, lot of gunners." He said, "Yeah." He said, "It's when they're quiet that you've got to watch them." He said, "If they're going crook, well, you know, it's all right." He said, "If they go quiet, you've got to watch them, because they're not too happy." You know, and that's the way it goes. Yeah, we had some good, fine soldiers in charge of the regiment. We were lucky that way, you know. And traditional soldiers, fellas whose fathers had been generals and brigadiers, one particular commanding officer was of German extraction, but he was born in Australia for German extraction. He's a particularly good soldier, you know, and very cluey artilleryman.
Did he have an opinion of the Germans?
Yeah, well, he, like everybody, we all thought the same.
Sorry, got an alarm going off somewhere. Sorry, I was interested to know whether this chap of German extraction had an opinion about the Germans and what was going on and what they were.
I don't think any difference to what we had as Australians, you know. I think that Australians have always respected Germans as soldiers, you know, the top soldiers, and he was of the same opinion, you know. But I don't think that he'd be telling me his opinion, but the way I struck him was that he is fair dinkum straight down the line, you know. That was the fact of Germans, him being a German, them being German, made no difference whatsoever. You know, his job was the job that he was doing.
Well, I understand that there were relatives and people that knew some of the Italian POWs, some of the Italians they were fighting against had actually been in Australia not that long before.
Yeah, well, I never struck anything like that in the fellas that I was with anyway, but there had to be, I suppose, you know, and the only fella I knew was a fella called Saffer, and his uncle was a top man up in Syria. And when the boys went up to Syria for a short period with the Vinci French up there, he really put it on for them, you know, dancing girls a lot. Saffer, little dark fella. Geez, a nice fella. Yeah, but as far as anybody knowing the Italians, I would have thought that that would have had to happen, but how they got in contact with them, I'd never know. And I personally don't know what happened to all the thousands of Italians that were captured. Of course, they were all in Tobruk, the ones that I saw, and then we moved on.
You mentioned Tobruk, obviously, and that would have been around about the 21st of January, 41.
Yeah.
So on the 7th of February, the 6th Division enters Benghazi. What was it like to see Benghazi for the first time?
Yeah, well, we had a very short period. My regiment, had a very short period in Benghazi because we were required up on the marshes, you know, Elagila, and we might have spent no more than 12 hours, 14 or 15 hours at the most, and then it was on the outskirts of it. So actually, as far as the city was concerned, I had never ever entered it.
What were you to do at outside Benghazi?
Well, they overrun that, you know. There wasn't even hardly a skirmish, but up on the plains, what would you call it, west of Benghazi, is where the British trapped the Italian tank force and belted the bloody daylights out of them, you know.
You mentioned the one particular small middle
size tank. Yeah.
You saw.
Yeah, it was a...
How did that... And you mentioned earlier on the experience of seeing the effects of your job. How did that then strike home for you?
My thoughts were, you know, basically, what a terrific waste of bloody life, even though they are the enemy. But what are the enemy of, you know? And the longer you live, the more you think back and wonder, question yourself whether the whole thing was ever worthwhile, which it wasn't, you know? It achieved nothing. It's just, the Germans trying to get a bit of living space, as Hitler said in Mein Kampf, you know? All he was looking for was a bit of living space. And of course, his pressure got more and more on him, and he got madder and madder, and like all the other great leaders in the world, you know, they seem to just go past that point, and one minute they're fabulous leaders, the next minute they're war criminals, and it all depends whether you win or lose, you know, what you are, in my opinion.
Well, certainly there's that question of whether if he didn't have the situation of the Jewish extermination, and had he not gone as far as he did, he might actually have gone down as one of the greatest leaders.
Oh, I think so. Oh, well, I do. You know, Germany was being forced onto its heels because of embargoes. So they were the greatest, probably the most skillful engineering company in the world at that time, because Britain was starting to slip a bit and the Germans were starting to come up, but they couldn't sell their goods because America and Britain used to block them off all the time. Well, not that I'm politically minded, but it seems, you know, there were doctors over there running around with picks and shovels in their hands. They had the expertise, but they had nowhere to work. So somebody's got to do something. Hitler done it and come unstuck. Like everybody that puts their feet out of line in modern society always comes unstuck.